This is the Simon Dell Show, where we take a deep dive into some of the week's most notable business and marketing stories and interview high-performing business leaders and marketing professionals to find out their lessons for success.
You might think that, and I might think this, but what does a customer think? Let's go and find that.
The benefit that we get from supporting free users outweighed that small increase in revenue. The biggest driver for us has been organic, so content marketing mostly.
Welcome to the Simon Dell Show, episode number 5252. Thank you very much for joining us. If you are here for your first time, then welcome. Hopefully you'll enjoy this and come back again for the next time. That would be fantastic. If you've been here before, welcome back. And you'll pretty much know the format of what is coming today. Now, today we have a gentleman that we are interviewing called James McGregor. He is the co-founder of a company called Biteable, and go and check them out, biteable.com. They are all about video and helping you make your own video. If you've ever used Canva or a product like that, then you'll understand what Biteable do, because they're kind of the Canva for video, for want of a better description, but extremely useful tool. And of course, if you are active in social media, online, wherever, then video is a massive part of what you do. And if it's not a massive part of what you do, it should be a massive part of what you do. So these guys have been running Biteable for about 5 years. They're based down in Tasmania, in Hobart. James has a lot of good insights as to, video, the benefits to the business, how to execute good video, and so on. So a great interview once again. Now, the usual bits and pieces from me, please rate and review us on iTunes. I think I said about 10, 15 episodes ago, we shifted our entire podcast database from SoundCloud to Audioboom. And in the process, I managed to lose all of the reviews. So well done, Simon. My finest work. Come and follow us on Instagram. It's now called simondell.com, spelled dotcom. And if you're looking at doing your own podcast, then have a chat with Gilberto. He is at thepodcastboss.com. And irrespective of wherever you are in the world, he can help you with the production of your podcast. And very finally, if you want to find out what myself and Matt Clarkson, my business partner, do, we are available at www.simondell.com. We help businesses of all shapes and sizes with their digital marketing, their digital transformations, anything from SEO campaigns, AdWords campaigns, all the way up to a big CRM marketing automation integrations. We've done some big projects last year. We're hopefully going to do some big projects this year. And if that's the sort of thing that you think your company needs some help with, then give us a shout. Email us at hello@simondell.com. Without further ado, let us jump in to the interview with James McGregor. Welcome to the show, James McGregor. How are you?
I'm very well. Thanks for having me, Simon.
Good, good, good. Now, you're down in Tasmania, aren't you? You're down in the Hobart office, did you say?
Yeah, I'm in the Biteable Hobart office this week.
And how is beautiful Tasmania today?
There are bushfires everywhere at the moment. There's like 40 bushfires in Tasmania at the moment,
right,
so
okay.
It's just weird.
Just don't burn to death whilst we're on the show.
No, we're trying not to.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. None around the office, so should be fine.
How did you end up in Tasmania then?
So I grew up in Hobart.
Okay.
I studied here, went to uni here, and then I lived away for about 16 years.
Yep.
And I moved back about 5 or 6 years ago.
And why Tasmania? That's where you grew up, but what's the attraction for you?
I moved back from England with my wife, and I'd lived in Melbourne and Sydney and London. And she got offered a contract. We just took a really long backpacking holiday, like a 3-month holiday, and she was emailing about jobs in Australia. Got offered a job in Hobart, and we just decided we needed to go somewhere quiet for a year, we thought we were going to do. And then we're kind of just still here. We just got really used to it. Yeah. And I've had two kids since then. And
right.
I think it was just we wanted, a change from London that was fairly full on.
Yeah, London is – that's why I came out here in the first place. So.
Yeah.
Fed up with getting stuck in traffic and fed up with the rain. That was pretty much
– pretty much, yeah, just, commuting and just slogging it out. We just wanted to slow down and have more time.
So tell us about Biteable. Mm-hmm. You're the CEO.
Yep.
Give us the – I was going to say, I said to everyone, give us the elevator pitch, but we're not in an elevator and the time isn't. You don't have to rush it. So yep. Tell us a little bit about Biteable.
Okay. So Biteable is a tool for making videos. You do it all in a browser, do it all online. Businesses use us for making promotional videos. They might make ads or explainer videos or job ads or plethora of different types of content. Generally, it's a short form video, so under a minute. We've got about 4 million users on the platform. There's about 32 of us working on Biteable now, and we started, I'm one of the co-founders and CEO, so actually started it with my brother 4 years ago. He also just moved back to Hobart at the time, and then we brought on a third co-founder, and we've just been head down on it since then.
One of the questions just on a previous podcast, Lady Cheryl Mack, who's the CEO of StartCon, is she talks about getting the right people and getting the right co-founders. Now, obviously with your brother, I don't know whether I could – I could possibly go into business with my brother now. We might just – we might kill each other within the first week, but,
We
could get away with it. How did you find your brother as a co-founder? But how did that all come about? And then how did you guys go about finding that third person as a co-founder?
Yeah, okay. So before I even started trying to find Biteable, when I moved back to Australia, I actually took a job as marketing director at Pollinizer, a startup incubator. So I've launched a few startups over the last decade or so, and some of them successful-ish and some of them not at all. And I was really interested in this model of like, how do you come up with an idea and validate it and put a team together, raise investment, all the bits to get a startup off the ground. And what I really noticed at Pollinizer was like the minimum, you kind of want to reduce the number of people involved in the early stages, and the minimum you needed was marketing, design, and engineering.
Yeah.
And so that was like the formula. That's why there's three founders. My brother's the designer, the other co-founder's the CTO, the engineer, and I'm the marketing, product guy.
Yep.
And so that was the basic kind of formula for it. Simon and I, he moved back here around the same time as me, and we rented a little office together, and we're both just doing consulting work. And we just tested a new startup idea every month for a year.
Okay. So like you had you started a new startup every month, or it was just testing an idea?
Just testing. They were all just at the, idea stage.
Yeah.
But we would build out a prototype. I would go and sell it to people, test it out, kind of take it to market straight away.
Yeah.
And it was just the two of us. So it was kind of we'd focus on the design and I've worked a lot in design-focused tools, so a lot of them were quite design-heavy.
Yeah.
And that was our, we basically had our own little incubator where we just incubated ideas for a year.
Yeah. And was Biteable one of those ideas?
Yeah. So Biteable was an interesting one. Simon, my co-founder and brother, is an animator and motion designer who's worked on film. And so
– okay.
During that consulting year, we started making explainer videos for our startups, and then people would, be impressed with the videos because they looked a lot better than what anyone else was doing on the web because they didn't really use a real animator. And so we started getting requests for jobs, and we were making custom explainer videos for people, and they just kept getting asked for it. Like whenever I pitched one of my startup ideas, people were like, yeah, the idea's all right, but I really love that video. And so it just, It took us probably, you know, a year of chipping away at that idea until we came up with a practical way to do it, because it's quite a big undertaking.
Yeah. Tell us how that idea came about then. How did that practical, what was it that you suddenly went, right, well, this is how we do it?
So we knew really quickly that there was demand. We were making explainer videos at the time, like little promotional videos for all different companies, mostly startups. And so we knew that they wanted the end product. We just didn't know how to produce a product that made it so that it wasn't right. Custom. And so we just kept pulling it apart. We were testing a whole bunch of video tech all year, just like, what if we did this? What if we did this? And it took about 10 months until I remember, you know, sketching up basically the current product design for Biteable. Like, what if we just had these simplified components and people stitch multiple pieces together to make a video and they could just edit specific things? We just both sort of looked at it and went, yeah, we could build that. That's doable, and we think it'll deliver value. It still felt very early stage. Like, it still felt like it probably wouldn't work.
Yeah, yeah. Where did you get the affirmation that it was working, that it was a decent tool that people could use?
So we built out, we were manually making videos for people to kind of test the concept. And that was kind of, we learned some stuff. We brought on a third co-founder, Tommy, who's a really amazing engineer that I'd worked with in a couple of startups previously. And so we built out the very first prototype over maybe a couple of months. And we just started, I started running ads and testing it on real users.
Yeah.
And it actually pretty quickly, we started to get people liking it and using it and making real videos. It was, you know, very MVP. Interestingly, compared to, you know, all the other ideas we tested, it sort of just got traction straight away.
Yeah. How did you decide the revenue model? Because I've worked with software startups. I still work with software startups. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I've worked with a video software startup. And I can remember a couple of years ago, 2-3 years ago, the arguments, and they were arguments, you know, mm-hmm. there's nothing wrong with having an argument, but the arguments about how it should be charged, how, mm-hmm. you know, freemium models versus subscriptions versus pay-as-you-go. How did that all pan out through the discussions?
In the early days, we really divvied things up into three camps. There was three founders, and so I was responsible for pricing, mm-hmm. you know, product decisions, marketing, pricing, stuff like that. So I just picked up. Initially we were charging per video.
Right.
Then people start to make quite a few videos and they complain it was too expensive. So I just picked a number and made that an annual subscription.
Right, yeah.
And then we've just iterated.
Just on that, when you picked a number, did you just genuinely sort of pluck it out of your ass and go, right, this is a number, let's call it this? Or was there any sort of detailed mathematical thought gone into it?
There was no mathematical thought. There was just, I picked a price point that was like from previous, you know, things that I've run, it's like a disposable price where people will they'll buy it. They don't have to go and ask for approval in a company.
Yeah.
They don't.
Yeah.
So it's like cheap enough that they can just make a decision there and then, but not so cheap that it's going to be impossible to make any money out of it.
Gotcha.
So we always in the very early days or for, you know, like the first years, the rule is we just tried to keep it as cheap as humanly possible.
Yeah.
And the thought was, unless the product's awesome, the rest of it just doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
And so we just put all our energy into the product for the first few years.
I'm going to say, I'm having a look at it here. So your annual subscription would be $276. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And just for anybody listening who's not in Australia, I'm assuming that, am I looking at that in Australian dollars?
That's all USD. So it's,
I know, USD.
Yeah, $29 okay, a month, or you can purchase annually and save like 20%.
Yeah.
So pricing is long and complicated.
Yeah.
There's been a lot of work on pricing, and it's one thing we're really focused on as a company now is listening to customers is number one.
Yeah.
Which actually saves a lot of the arguments. Because it's just like, well, you might think that and I might think this, but what does the customer think? Let's go and find that.
Yeah.
And then we really focus on being adaptive to users over time. So as we bring on, you know, at the moment we're getting a lot of enterprise customers and universities, our pricing will change. And it's just about adapting to what the market tells us over time.
And feel free not to answer this, because I'm always fascinated with a B2C. Well, I know you have B2B as well, but you know, that kind of model. I'm fascinated between the split between those that would be paying monthly versus those that are paying yearly. And I'm also fascinated to understand, is there much of a upgrade to people that are paying monthly, and then, you know, a few months in they decide to start paying annually because they see the value in it? Or do they just sort of live in two completely separate camps?
At the moment, they mostly live in two separate camps.
Right.
There's not a great push in the app to upgrade, you know, migrate people between plans. That will change over time.
Yeah.
The split, it's, you know, more, a lot more monthly than annual.
Yeah.
I actually couldn't tell you what the current split is. We, I used to do all the pricing and run all the, we run a lot of pricing experiments and, you know, spend way too many hours looking at that side of it. And for the last year, we've had a pricing team. So there's a team of three people that sit down and they do pricing experiments every couple of weeks.
Yeah. And that, and I guess that, that you then sort of look at that data and, you know, make your decisions based on what they're coming up with.
I just mostly just look at the test results, like how did that go. So we've done, you know, radical things like tested turning off freemium altogether, increasing pricing, reducing pricing, having multiple plans.
Give me that, give me on an experiment where if you turned off freemium, can you tell us that? I mean, again, you don't need to be detailed because these are your business numbers.
Yeah.
But what's the consequence of turning off freemium for you?
At the time when we turned it off, we saw maybe a 10% increase in conversions to paid. So we changed freemium to a trial, and the benefit that we get from, you know, supporting free users outweighed that small increase in revenue.
Okay, so sorry, I'm going to keep asking questions here because I've got a this is really useful for one of my clients.
Okay.
So just so everyone understands out there, the difference between freemium and a trial is, do you want to just explain that?
Yeah, so freemium, you're just on a free plan and you can use that free plan forever. So we always, you know, grandfather a plan that someone signs up to, they'll have that plan forever. When we test, we only test on new users. So we tested on new users that rather than getting a free, you know, lifetime plan, they would get a 7-day trial, which is quite common, you know, for SaaS companies. Some of the companies in our space. For us, it wasn't a significant impact. But it doesn't mean that down the track it won't be something we revisit.
Right. So what you were saying is when you move from the freemium model to the trial, it did increase the number of subscribers.
Yeah, so it increased.
But not significantly enough to actually, you know,
to cost justify it. Not really, because obviously there's a freemium is really a marketing decision. It's not, you know, a pure pricing. It's really a marketing play. So, you know, you have a bigger audience. They can help you promote the product, which they do. You know, we're organically led, all of our marketing. And they also give you a bigger audience to develop the product on and, you know, speed up development of the features for everyone.
Yeah.
So it's a complicated one. The problem with freemium is it's really hard to put a value on it for the business.
Yeah. Yeah.
In my experience, most SaaS companies shouldn't be freemium. It's a really a mass market play, and you have to be able to leverage that audience and actually get them to drive your marketing for it to make any sense.
Yeah. What percentage, and I know I've said this multiple times, but again, mm-hmm. you don't have to tell me this, but what percentage of people would you see upgrading from freemium to paid?
We don't really give out those numbers.
Okay.
But it's a small percent of, the free users convert to paid.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, cool. That's fine. My next question for you, because you're the marketing brains behind this, I guess Biteable is pretty much its own marketing tool, really. Mm-hmm. Because, you're creating videos that you can show people how they can create videos. So, it's a bit of a no-brainer in that respect. But what channels work best for you for recruiting new users?
So the biggest driver for us has been organic, so content marketing mostly.
Okay.
Building into the product, the ability for people to share their videos that obviously attracts other users. And then over the last year, we also we're now running paid channels, but still by far the biggest driver for us is content marketing.
Okay. Give me an example of what you guys would do from a content marketing perspective and where you would sort of seed that content.
Content marketing is pretty broad for us. So I think our guiding principle is we try and build content that is really useful to users, either our own audience or just educating the potential audience. And so we do a lot of things. We obviously produce videos, blog posts, a lot of social media content. We've just started publishing really in-depth ebooks.
Okay.
Really in-depth guides where we've had, five writers over 3 months writing them. Case studies, it's really just testing, continually putting new stuff out there and just seeing what actually resonates with users.
From a paid channel, what's been working best for you? I presume Facebook is, and Google and those kind of things.
But pretty much AdWords and Facebook.
Yeah.
So AdWords, because we've got a background in search and we understand that really well and it ties in with our content marketing, it's kind of just like a natural add-on. Whereas Facebook, social in general for paid acquisition is very new territory.
Yeah.
So it works for us. It's got lots of potential. It's still a small driver of the business.
Do you analyze the return on investment from those channels?
I used to just experiment on everything and I'd make a call like Facebook ads don't work, but the devil's in the detail. And so now what we do is we generally continually do little pilots on new channels, and if we see some type of success, we try and have a dedicated person on that channel. So we have someone who just does Facebook ads, someone who just does AdWords, etc.
Have you found Facebook ads in the last couple of years? Because my experience would be that it's taken the ROI from a Facebook ad has taken a bit of a hammering in the past year or so. Just interested if that's the sort of insight that you guys have seen as well.
Oh, the prices are going up, definitely. And I've been promoting software companies mostly for the last 20 years, so I saw the same thing with AdWords. Definitely it's getting more expensive, but it's so powerful. There's so much targeting. You can do really unique things. So it doesn't necessarily matter.
Yeah.
Like paid acquisition is all about your target audience and your lifetime value.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
It's more expensive. Maybe it doesn't make it you know, great sense for a lot of freemium tools.
Yeah.
For us, it kind of makes sense, but we also, because we're a video marketing platform, we also just want to experiment on all the things that our customers try and do.
Right.
And so we sort of have a dual purpose with paid acquisition, that we're, you know, trying to find scalable channels, but we're also just trying to understand those channels so we can educate our users and build new products around, you know, interesting capabilities.
You've obviously video is a, you know, the growth of video in the last few years has been, you know, massive, and as mm-hmm. the route to the internet becomes easier and easier with smartphones and tools like yourself, more people get into mm-hmm. it. What are yeah. some of the things that work best from video? If you've got somebody that's sat in front of you saying, I want to produce videos, I want to just produce promotional videos, what are perhaps the two mm-hmm. or three key things that you think people should remember when it comes to producing videos for their business?
That is a very broad one. Let me have a think.
It is a bit, but
there's a lot of things.
Yeah.
I think firstly, video itself is very broad. It covers a lot of different types of videos. So Bidable is really good for some of them, really terrible for other of them. So what works for business is to produce different types of videos, to always test.
Yeah.
You know, whatever, what worked for us may not work for you, but we just try and, you know, test lots of different types of content. So short form videos that we specialize in, they are really good for explaining things that are really difficult to get across. You know, most people don't read your blog posts.
Yeah.
They don't want to read a long page of features. They're more likely to watch a 30-second video that just covers the five dot points, is really entertaining. So they're sort of like quick summaries of information, and they work really well for getting people to take the next step.
What do you see then, perhaps, if I rephrase the question, what do you see people mm-hmm. doing videos and they do it and it's badly, and it kind of one of those things where it, you know, raises the hair on the back of your neck and you just go, oh.
I guess as a company, the thing that we struggle with is just really poor quality videos.
What's your definition of poor quality? Because there'll be people out there that are producing videos mm-hmm. that they think are absolutely great. And I've seen mm-hmm. them and I go, oh my God, that's terrible. But they think they're great.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
How should people be going, this is not good? What's a rough benchmark for that?
It's a tough one. We have a team of, you know, motion designers in the office, so obviously we're very biased. But I think if it looks like a PowerPoint that is animated,
yeah,
it's probably going to feel really cheap to the user.
Yeah.
What video is best at is getting an emotional reaction out of the users, which you can do with imagery, you can do with language, but video, because of sound and motion and, you know, the number of elements that you have to play with,
yeah,
you can have a lot deeper connection. Like, people can really, really react to a video. So, for example, my wife made a video with Bidable late last year and shared it, and it was a little explainer video covering a health topic. I haven't watched it, but it's had like 100,000 views and a couple of thousand shares.
Right.
She works for the health department here on nutrition, sort of educating people about nutrition and health. And it just, the message, the whole package just really resonated with a certain audience.
Yeah.
And they just shared the hell out of it.
Yeah.
So I think the key with video is just pumping out a whole lot of videos that are just really average doesn't work.
Right.
It's producing something that when someone watches, they actually feel something.
One of the other challenges I see a lot of is voiceovers, mm-hmm. voiceovers and whether to use captions or things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Explain to me how that works on Bidable, and then maybe I want to get an understanding of how mm-hmm. people can do a voiceover without, you know, breaking the bank.
Yeah. So most biteable videos, interestingly, don't have a voiceover.
Okay.
When we first built the platform, we didn't have the capability. And we just, because we'd made explainer videos that were a bit longer form, we just assumed it was something we were going to have to add. We just hadn't gotten to.
Yeah.
And what we found was people were making shorter and shorter videos, sort of between 10 seconds and a minute. And that because the message is written in the video, having a voiceover didn't add anything.
Yeah.
Music actually works a lot better for that style of video. So people do record a voiceover and add it over the top. But generally, it's better for a longer form video. And that's usually something that's either custom made or it's right. a product walkthrough or, you know, an actual like this, an actual case study or, you yeah. know, something more in depth.
Yeah.
So I think people sort of use us for two things, either to condense explaining a topic really quickly or just pure marketing where they're just trying to capture attention.
Yeah.
And neither of those you need voiceover for.
Right. Right. Aside from your wife's video, which you're not allowed to plug anymore, what's some of the ones that you've seen? I mean, you mentioned some case studies there. I'd be interested. Mm-hmm. There's some on your website, but what's your favorite? Yeah. What's your favorite biteable video that's been produced by somebody else?
There's a team that looks at case studies, so I'm not like completely up to date. But the craziest one that I saw was about 2 years ago. Somebody sent us this link for a video someone had made and shared on Facebook, and it had 23 million views.
Right.
And we just kept looking at it going, that can't be right. And it was just like,
surely that's a mistake. Yeah.
And we just kept looking at it like, surely they've got some link farm, you know, like people are just clicking on that. It's going to be fake. And we ended up getting in contact with them and ran a case study on them. And they were just making like really inspirational videos.
Yeah.
That really opened my eyes that if the video, even if it's, you know, simple, if it really resonates with the audience, it can just go really crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, that one still for me, I still look at it and go, wow, that's too many views. They didn't run any ads or anything. Like, we've had nowhere near that many views on anything we've ever done, you know.
What I just want to, I mean, there's obviously a lot more we can talk about video, but I think you've obviously had quite a background in, you know, product marketing, mm-hmm. all those kind of things.
Yeah.
I think one of the other ones I wanted to ask you about was moo.com.
Mm-hmm.
You were there for about a year.
Yep.
And explain for everyone's benefit what moo.com is out there.
So Moo is an online tool for making business cards. The amazing thing with Moo is the cards are better than you're probably going to get from anyone, whether it's a right. local designer or a little print house, but they're really cheap.
Yeah.
And so I was lucky enough to be a product manager there. I worked on Moo for Business. It was one of my projects. And I was already a Moo fan, you know, like I went and sort of
right.
seeked them out and wanted to work there. And what I discovered at Moo was they just put a lot of time and effort into that product, some yeah. of it like insanely so. You know, the card quality, they wouldn't outsource the printing. They only owned their own print factories. They'd written all this software okay. that did, you know, really unique things when it cut up the cards and
yeah.
Just so much detail into a very simple product. But the outcome was it's amazing value. And yeah. it really came across in the brand. Like, people just love Moo.
Whenever I've seen them, their communication has just been really spot on. They do that really well.
Yeah.
The engagement with the end user.
Yeah, definitely. We actually had a chat with the head of customer service recently to get some tips about, you know, how do we expand our customer service team.
Yeah.
And we worked with their head of brand who did our rebrand last year. So definitely very inspired by Moo. You know, what I came away, my last two big projects had been Moo, and then I was with Interspire before that and helped launch BigCommerce in Europe.
Yeah.
And so what I, both of them were, you know, successful and really interesting. And what I wanted was a startup that had the, you know, amazing brand of Moo, but Moo is, you know, quite consumer and disposable, and business wise, it's actually reasonably difficult business.
Yeah.
And then the market opportunity of BigCommerce, which are e-commerce stores all over the world that spend, you know, millions on advertising and get amazing value out of the BigCommerce platform. So yeah, it was like, okay, I want to do something like, you know, sort of with the feel of Moo, but just that adds a bit more value and is more business focused.
Yeah.
And somehow, yeah, that's sort of, we landed there with Bartable.
One of the other things that I've seen is common to yourself is and Moo is this, is the Trustpilot rating. And Trustpilot's actually, and God knows how long I've been in marketing, but it's actually something I only really sort of discovered last year. Mm-hmm. Do you find that that's for you? Do you find that's a benefit? Do people kind of, what's the word? Do people trust you more when they see that Trustpilot ranking?
I don't spend a lot of time on Trustpilot. There's another, you know, one of the team members that's his whole initiative, and yeah, he runs it. We've definitely seen we get really good reviews with Trustpilot. We're a, you know, Trustpilot subscriber, so you've got to kind of sign up. And I think we always focus a lot. We've always focused on transparency.
Right.
And
right,
one thing that Trustpilot's good is just a really easy way for your actual subscribers to share their feedback about yeah, the service. And we just didn't really have a way for that. We would encourage people to tweet or try and look for quotes in support tickets. So I guess Trustpilot's just a way of automating that.
Yeah. All right, last three questions. The third to last question is, what are some of the other brands, and not necessarily ones that you've worked with, but some other mm-hmm, brands that you really like, things that you buy frequently, you know, mm-hmm, things that you perhaps draw lessons from and ideas from?
Mm-hmm. The two brands that I really follow is obviously Moo.com and another English startup called Wonderbly, which are online kids books, which you personalize okay, for your child, which is, again, just mind-blowingly awesome product. But yeah, both okay, of those yeah, two, that's definitely on the product side of it.
Actually, I think I got one of these. I have a 9 week old, so I think okay, I got one. I think I got given one.
Awesome. Yeah. I love,
there one they of are, the beautiful fan, books.
Yeah. And then, so yeah, digitally probably those two and, you know, lots of other SaaS tools. And then the real world examples of similar things like producing really quality products on scale at amazing value are things like Uniqlo, IKEA.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm just really interested in that model of how are they kind of bringing like at least as good a quality product or often a lot higher than, you know, existed previously, but yeah, at amazingly good value, and do you think there's all around the world.
Do you think there's a shift now, and we're going to go completely off on a tangent here, but now you've mentioned mm-hmm, Uniqlo and IKEA, do you think there's a shift mm-hmm, from the consumer looking for end products that are now going to perhaps outlast them a season or outlast or at least last them longer than perhaps this H&M and Zara approach, which was you know, quick fashion, quick turnaround fashion that you buy mm-hmm, something, it's cheap, and then mm-hmm, 6 weeks later you buy something else. Mm-hmm. I kind of wonder whether Uniqlo and IKEA are sort of stuck in that middle. Mm-hmm. where they want you to, you know, they want you to have things for a long time. But yeah, I wonder whether there's a shift now. Do you see that happening?
I don't follow consumer trends as much, but I would assume that it's the opposite, that people have gotten really used to everything being cheap and disposable.
Right.
I would like to think that there's a wave of quality that's coming back where people are more, you know, we've definitely seen in the last 5 years that people want things that are handmade and
yeah,
and back to that craftsmanship. Customized. And, you know, I strangely rarely buy things on the web. I love,
yeah,
you know, going out and shopping and, yeah, just things that are a little more handmade generally,
yeah, yeah,
and quality. But I don't think it's the current trend. I think it's okay, kind of the opposite. But I hope it kind of, you know, people start to seek out the better versions of things and are prepared to support the producers, and that it kind of reverses.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know where IKEA sits in that, but probably. No,
I think IKEA is in one of those. Yeah, it is in a strange, it's in a strange, strange position because, you know, traditionally a lot of people didn't expect IKEA stuff to last, you know. But
mm-hmm,
I think now when you spend money on a piece of furniture, you know, you expect some longevity out of it rather than it falls apart in a year's time. But
yeah.
Anyway, second to last question. What's in the pipeline for Buy to Ball in 2019? Is there anything that any new products, any new features, things that you can tell us about, or you know, just keep us hooked at things that you can't tell us about? But
yeah, definitely. So for the last 4 years, we've been building out Buy to Ball with a single product. For the last 6 months, we've been building a first of our second products, which is a tool that's more focused on social media content. So you can do a whole bunch of things more specific for social media that the current platform doesn't cater to.
Yeah.
And this year we're moving to this mindset and framework of producing multiple products. We've always had a single product development team and just, you know, sort of always done one thing at a time.
Yeah.
And now we're breaking up, and the plan is we already have two product development teams. We should have a third shortly. And the plan is to start building out a suite of products that do kind of really specific, unique things, all in video marketing.
Okay.
And just to be doing a lot more things in parallel.
Okay. Interesting. Final question. If people want to ask you a question, if they, you know, want to chat, where's the best place to find you?
Yeah, just email me at james@buytable.com.
Cool.
Yeah, happy to chat anytime.
You on LinkedIn or Twitter or anything else as well?
Yep. Or ping me on Twitter or connect with me on LinkedIn. Cool. But I'm always, like, I've got a zero inbox policy, so if you email me, I will check it. I do check it every day, and I do respond.
Cool. Awesome. Mate, thank you very much for your time today. It's been an absolute pleasure. And obviously, I'd recommend everybody out there listening, go and check out buytable.com. But, you know, thank you for your time today.
Great. Nice chatting. Thanks, Simon.
Thank you very much. It has been a pleasure having you here, either for your first time or having you back again. Hope you enjoyed the interview with James. Hope you learned a few things about using video. Once again, please rate and review us on iTunes. Otherwise, we will see you next week.